Good afternoon. It's 2:59, almost 3 p.m., and it's time for another edition of A Juno Afternoon. I'm Ken Fix. I'll be your host for today. And on the show, we'll be talking with Carlene Grummet about the Empty Chair Project. We'll continue our Fish 101 series with guest Ross Cohen, offering a preview of his talk Thursday about Alaskan fishermen and the Japanese invasion of Bristol Bay. We'll also find out about Sitka's Island Institute with our guest Carolyn Servite. These guests, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and some more for Wednesday, July 9th, 2014. Stay tuned. National Native News is up first.
This is National Native News. I am Antonia Gonzalez. During this year's World Cup, Native American fans in the U.S. cheered on Kiowa player Chris Wondolowski. As for indigenous people in Brazil, when the games kicked off, Guarani Indians used the opening ceremony to draw attention to land rights. Young people held up a banner in Portuguese reading demarcation now, meaning land recognition now. There are more than 400 indigenous groups in Brazil waiting for their ancestral lands to be officially recognized. And as Lucia Duncan reports, Brazil's powerful agricultural lobby is working against them.
The Brazilian Congress is considering a constitutional amendment that would transfer authority over land recognition from the Agency of Indian Affairs to Congress. The current constitution recognizes indigenous people as the original inhabitants of the country, with a right to enough land to continue their culture and way of life. Danielle Piahi is an anthropologist who works for a Guarani advocacy organization. He compares the amendment to a fox wanting to guard the hen house.
Brazil's Congress is dominated by large landowners, and so there is conflict of interest. Those who are opposed to increasing indigenous land want to be responsible for regulating it.
Public hearings on the landowners' amendment have been held throughout Brazil. Piahi says members of the agricultural lobby tell property owners that Indians are going to take their land. Meanwhile, indigenous groups waiting for their land to be recognized face an uncertain future. Guarani chief Garay Miring says his people received an eviction notice.
We're a people without life and we feel it. Our kids don't have a future. We're at the end of a process and we're really worried.
The Guarani and other indigenous groups in Brazil are protesting and organizing against both the constitutional amendment and many other laws that would erode their land rights. For National Native News, I'm Lucia Duncan in Sao Paulo, Brazil.
A Fairbanks radio station is broadcasting programs aimed at the Native community in Alaska's interior. Another group hopes to launch its station early next year to provide radio programming for groups they say are not being served. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
KRFF reminds its listeners at the top of every hour that Native people in the interior have a new voice.
Dayenta, you're listening to 89.1 KRFF. Fairbanks.
The station was launched last November by the Athabascan Fiddlers Association. Ann Fears is the association's general manager, and she's the driving force behind KRFF.
It's a culturally focused radio station, but it should be for the purpose of serving the whole interior, all the people, all the listeners.
KRFF's signal reaches as far as Nenana to the west and Delta Junction to the east. It'll go worldwide when the station sets up web streaming, which Fears says should happen soon. KRFF mostly airs Native Voice 1 programming, but Fears says KRFF is developing more local programming, like the morning show that debuted in February, including, they hope, a regular call-in feature with news and information about rural Alaskans.
They have a lot of stories to tell. They would be telling their story, and we would all be learning from the Alaska Native people and people of the interior.
Fears says KRFF also hopes to expand its entertainment offerings, like its live music broadcasts by local performers, including, of course, the Athabascan Fiddlers. The Fiddlers Association supports KRFF largely through gaming revenues. For National Native News, I'm Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Alaska.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Not voting is not rebelling, it's surrendering. Your voice counts when you vote. First, you have to register. Find out more at nativevote.org. Brought to you by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation.
And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And before we get rolling with our first guest today, I've got a public service announcement to read this. This is kind of making me angry. Juneau Police and the Alaska Electric Light and Power Company want people to know about a telephone scam that hit the capital city today. Several businesses and residential customers report getting phone calls from a person saying that their power will be cut off in 45 minutes if they don't make an immediate payment. The caller has been telling people to go to Walmart or Fred Meyer and buy a prepaid green dot or credit card to make the payment. Of course, this is a fraudulent call. Utility companies do not operate by demanding cash or threatening people over the phone. It's actually illegal for them to cut you off until a lot of other measures are exhausted. AELNP spokeswoman Debbie Driscoll says that the scam is similar to several that have hit Juneau in the last few months. So if you get one of these, don't go rushing out to buy a prepaid card to make this so-called payment. It's a fraudulent call, and I'm sure that the police and the Alaska Electric Light and Power Company are all looking into this right now. But let's get underway with my first guest, who is Carlene Grummet, and she's here to talk with us about the Empty Chair Project. Hi, Carlene. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you.
This is a pretty somber topic. I'll give you that right off the top. But let's talk about what brought the Empty Chair Memorial Project about. This is related to a very sad story in World War II about the forced relocation of Japanese citizens from not only the west coast of the United States, but Alaska. And that's what this whole project is about, is it not?
It is. How the project, the local project, started was at a meeting, not a meeting, a presentation by Betty Marriott, who was interned, and she's a local lady. And we had been hearing about the internment through different sources. My sister and I, when I say we, I mean my sister Marjorie, who's the chair of this project. And that's when we started doing some local research to find out. We knew that there had been Japanese taken from Juneau during World War II because one of Marjorie's very dear friends was taken. And she didn't know about it for many, many years. And most of us didn't know about the Japanese being taken and interned from Juneau. It's not in history books. It's not anything we learned in school. And the Japanese chose not to talk about it. They wanted to move on once the war was over. So we were investigating what research had been done in Juneau. And we were sent to Marie Darlin, who's our local historian here. And she was in the class of 1943, and she happened to have a file. She said, I just happen to have a file here that I've been saving just for a time when somebody would write this or tell about this story of the empty chair. And, of course, we didn't know what she was talking about. And so we pursued some research that she with papers that she'd given us, and we found out that 35 Japanese were taken from Juneau on an Army transport ship to Seattle, where this was April of 1942, with very little warning, and they were taken to Seattle, and of all names, they were taken to a place called Camp Harmony for assembly. And they were there for 3 months, and most of them, well, most Alaskans were taken to Camp Minidoka in Idaho in a desert area. They were taken by train. They didn't know where they were going. And when they got there, they found barbed wire fence surrounding the camp with armed guards with guns pointed inside. There were barracks of about 6 rooms. I think it was like an 8x12 room for complete families with a cot and a pot-bellied stove. And that was the beginning of their internment.
Okay, let's rewind the history just a smidge. It's aggravating that we have treated American citizens, you know, with far less dignity than we treat illegal aliens that are coming into this country. It just floors me. But let's go back to Roosevelt's executive order,
yes,
which was signed February 19th of 1942. Let's talk a little bit about that. What criteria were used to say that these people need to be gathered up and relocated?
Well, what they were told and what other people were told was that it was for their own protection.
Right.
Because the only people taken, of course, were along the West Coast, which was,
yes,
the endangered part of, you know, the fear the Japanese would get that far and start bombing our cities. And I couldn't tell you what all the criteria was, but that is what they were told, and that's what everyone else was told. And, of course, there was a lot of hysteria at the time. And so...
All right. That little tactic has not been repeated since. And, I mean, there's a lot of people that are in uproar about executive orders and what a president is able to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I guess it would require a little bit more research to find out what the scope of that executive order was.
Yes.
And how that, you know, criteria was used. Because, basically, you've relocated United States citizens. Some,
yeah,
of them whose parents had already been born in the United States.
Well, the Japanese Americans, the citizens, the second generation, they were taken to Minidoka, but the fathers were taken to what they called Department of Justice incarceration camps. I mean, they were prisoners,
right,
of war, and they were taken practically the next day, not very long after the war started. They were taken to the jail here that used to be up where the state office building is now and incarcerated, and they didn't see their families for 3 years.
Again, just somewhat maddening as to how these people were treated. The specific story about the Tanaka family, can you expand a little bit on that for us?
Well, the Tanaka family owned the City Cafe restaurant, and had for, I think he came in 1905, and the restaurant started about 1912, I believe. Anyway, they were a very well-known family. They worked very hard, and I don't know what else you want to know about the Tanaka family. Do you want to know about their personal experience?
Sure.
The only,
yes,
thing that,
definitely,
I know,
yeah,
that Alice, who is going to be here, one of the four that are still surviving that will be here for the dedication, she said that they saw the ship come into the channel, and they knew that it was the ship that would be taking them away because it was a different ship. It had a different color than any of the other ships, like the Alaska steamships that would come in here. And but they didn't know when, and they were... when they got the notice that they had to be at a certain time up at I think it was Gastineau Avenue behind their home, they left their dishes in the sink and left it just immediately and were taken on an army transport. She can remember climbing into the truck down to the dock and being taken aboard. And the sad thing was is that there were people who were their friends that had to transport them with rifles, and we're told, if you don't do it, we'll have somebody else do it. And it was gut-wrenching for them. In fact, a former doctor here, Dr. Rood, his son, was a classmate of John Tanaka. And years later, when John wasn't well and was dying, he went to visit his friend, and he said, we should have lain down on the gangplank. We should have done something. We should never have let them take you. So it was traumatic for everyone. It was for those taken and for those that were left and that had to see their friends leave.
Okay, now we know at that time this was June 6th of 1942.
When they took them was April.
They took them in April, okay. Well, we also had an event that happened that, I don't know if somewhat related to this, but the only invasion of U.S. territory in World War II by the Japanese was two Alaskan islands at the end of the Aleutian chain. And that went on June 3rd of 1942, where they occupied Attu and Kiska. And, you know, we fought over that for about a year before we regained those two islands. But, again, hardly anybody's talking about that either.
Nobody knew about it.
Yeah, except, you know, I'm just wondering how much of this had been kept under wraps and, you know, a lot of information was kept from the American public.
Well, there was a lot about the taking the Japanese from Juneau. I mean, nobody knew exactly when that ship was coming. And they would, even in the few articles that we did find in the newspaper, would not give any information about times or dates because of security. Security was the...
Oh, yeah, that's the buzzword that we use today for
and
everything that they don't want us to know.
That's right.
Yeah, I think with a lot more information is available, you know, security or not, mm-hmm. you know, because we have so much information flow these days through the internet and various other sources. Yeah, it's you can't keep stuff hidden for very long. You know, it comes out very easily and quickly. Again, back to the families. Upon return, some of the families that were relocated from Juneau were treated much better than some of the families, let's say, from Washington State down through California.
Yes, we've heard horrible stories about what happened to a lot of people outside of Juneau. And we had two main families, the Sadikafe Tanakas and the Juneau
Laundry.
Yeah, the Fukuyamas.
Mm-hmm.
And the Tanakas decided to come back. The Fukuyamas chose not to because he was quite elderly and decided he didn't want to start all over again and stayed in Seattle. But when the Tanakas came back, they were greeted by the owners of the Scandinavian rooms at that time, the Tanners, and they invited them to stay with them until they could get their home back, you know, more livable. And they were also greeted by the Hermleys. The Hermleys were a family that owned the home grocery here, and they were friends prior to the Tanakas leaving. They were business friends, and they greeted them as well. So they felt welcomed back, and they were concerned about whether people would come back to the cafe once they got it running. And they did get it up and running, thanks to Mr. Tanaka's two sons, John Tanaka and Bill Tanaka, and the people came back, and that they were very happy about that.
All right, and now I'm going to move forward and talk a little bit about the exhibit that opened in the Juneau Douglas Museum. That was open on June 2nd.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk just a little bit about that.
Well, Jane Lindsay and Jody, I can't say her last name, DeBriune, I think I'm murdering it.
That's all right. We butcher names all the time here.
But they were wonderful. Along Mary Tanaka, that was she and Alice, were very involved in getting that display going. And, in fact, the day that it opened, when I showed up, just to see what it was going to look like. Jody had an electric drill and was still putting things together, and it's a wonderful exhibit. There are personal bios and artifacts, and it's actually very stirring. In fact, one of the people that came out of it said, you need to have a box of Kleenex when you come in here to see this exhibit, because they felt it was quite powerful. So if you haven't seen it, I recommend.
Oh, yeah.
Highly recommend people.
Oh, yeah. It makes you sad.
Yeah. But it's nice that we're able to tell the story. I mean, finally, that we're able to tell the story. And that's been the most important part to me, is that there's been a voice for this experience.
All right, Carlene, and tell everybody about the memorial dedication, when and where that's going to be.
The dedication's Saturday at 2 o'clock in Capitol School Park, which is on 5th and North Franklin Streets. And it's at 2 o'clock, and following the dedication is going to be a little tour of the old high school gym for those that want to go where the actual empty chair event occurred, the John Tanaka, the valedictorian, who couldn't stay, who was taken, and they left an empty chair for him in his honor and to all of the Japanese who were taken, and that's why it's called the empty chair. So, and then the museum will have free admission all day starting at noon on Saturday for anyone who would like to come and see the exhibit that hasn't seen it yet.
Very good. All right, and there really isn't a website for this, but I suppose you can go on the one for
there
the
There is
Juno.
A website for
oh,
the empty chair.
Oh, there is one. Okay.
The empty chair is
Oh, we can Google this here while we're sitting here.
Emptychairproject.wordpress.com.
Okay, you got it. All right, I didn't have to go to Google here to figure that out.
No.
All right, very good. Carlene Grummet, this, again, it's a sobering topic, and everybody needs to know a little bit about this that lives here. If they haven't been touched by it, they should be, because this is just maddening what was done. But again, the memorial dedication is coming up, and for those that like to attend, again, you can figure out where that's going to be and when. And, of course, the exhibit that's still at the Juno Douglas City Museum. Carlene Grummet, thank you so much for being our first guest on the show today.
Thank you very much, Ken.
Clouds so swift, the rain falling in. Gonna see a movie called Gung the Din. Pack up your money, pull up your tent with Gwen. You ain't going nowhere. Ooh, we ride me high. Tomorrow's the day that my bride's gonna come. Ooh, we gonna fly down into the easy chair. His brother Don couldn't keep on keeping on. We'll climb that bridge after it's gone, after we're way past it. Ooh, we ride me high. Tomorrow's the day that my brides are gonna come. Ooh, we are we gonna fly down into the easy chair. That thing, a flute that toots and a bee that sings, a sky that cries and a bird that flies, a fish that walks and a dog that talks. Ooh, we ride me high. Tomorrow's the day that my brides are gonna come. Ooh, we are we gonna fly down into the easy chair.
Hi, I'm Janet Grange, host of Tuesday Morning Soundings on KRNN. I listen to KRNN because I can always count on a variety of music, from jazz and blues to folk and classical. It's always a pleasant surprise what other announcers play and have to say about the music. KRNN 102.7 FM. Tune in.
And it's 3:24 p.m. A Juno Afternoon continues with our Fish 101 series. This has got to be about the sixth or seventh installment. My guest now in the studio is Ross Cohen, and he's going to preview his talk on Thursday about Alaskan fishermen and the Japanese invasion of Bristol Bay. Well, Ross, nice to meet you, and
thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about this invasion.
Well, I'll be talking about the Japanese invasion of Bristol Bay. As you mentioned, this was in 1937. That year, approximately two dozen Japanese fishing vessels entered Bristol Bay, intent on participating in the red salmon fishery. And as you can probably imagine, this infuriated the Bristol Bay fishermen, who felt that they had a proprietary interest in those salmon. And when these Japanese fishing vessels arrived and began catching large numbers of salmon, by some estimates as many as 20,000 fish, the Alaskans demanded some sort of response by the federal government to exclude the Japanese fishermen and establish Bristol Bay as a uniquely American fishery.
And how successful were they with that?
Well, they were successful. It took about 40 years.
Okay, I see the wheels of progress move slow here.
It took quite a while. A couple of things happened right off the bat. The first thing that really happened was the Bristol Bay fishermen went to Washington, D.C., and they appealed to the federal government for some kind of relief, and they sought a legislative or a diplomatic solution. Now, international law, and I don't need to get into the intricacies of it, but international law at the time held that a state had legal jurisdiction over its offshore waters only 3 miles off the coast. So when these Japanese fishing vessels arrived and were 20, 50, 100 miles off the coast, they were breaking no international law. They were well within their rights to be there. So what the fishermen wanted Congress to do was basically extend that territorial border 200, as many as 400 miles, and enclose all of Bristol Bay. That wasn't ultimately done, but the fishermen began to articulate ownership of the salmon themselves in some really interesting ways. One of the things that they said was that, you know, because these salmon are born in Alaska rivers, streams, and lakes, and then because the adult salmon return to those same rivers, streams, and lakes to spawn and die years later, they remain possessions of Alaska even when the fish migrate out into the open sea during their life cycle. And so for the Japanese to harvest those salmon out onto the open ocean when they're beyond that territorial limit is still qualifies as theft. It's almost like, you know, if I go to your house to steal your car, it doesn't matter if your car is parked in the garage, the driveway, or out on the street, it's still theft. And that's the claim that the fishermen were making. It doesn't matter if the salmon are in the streams, in the territorial waters, or out on the open ocean, it still constitutes theft.
Right. Okay, that's almost the same argument that, say, California made when people retired and moved to Arizona. And they said, well, you still owe us California tax on this money. And they said, no, we don't. And they were taxed. It was called source taxing. They were taxing them. This sounds like almost the same sort of scenario and the same logic that they were using to relate the fish as, you know, something that they possessed simply because of their location. That's like California saying, well, you guys owe us taxes because you earn your money here. We don't care if you moved out of state. You know, we're still going to tax you. And ultimately, the federal government struck that down and said, oh, no, you don't, and forced them to repay the money.
Well, and the tricky thing about this Bristol Bay fisheries case is, how do you establish a boundary out on the open ocean? It's one thing to establish a boundary between California and Arizona on land.
Right, there's an easy physical boundary to designate, whereas this is much harder.
How do you do it out on the ocean?
Right.
That's right. Yeah. Another claim that was made by the fishermen is that, you know, these rivers and streams that empty into Bristol Bay, they carry with them huge quantities of alluvium, which is loose, unconsolidated silt, gravel, soil, sand. And then the streams deposit that alluvium on the seafloor of Bristol Bay. And so because you have Alaskan earth that's being scattered on the sea floor of Bristol Bay, well, doesn't that make Bristol Bay just a submarine extension of Alaska itself? And so aren't any ocean resources, such as the salmon, that are swimming over this Alaskan soil on the sea floor, don't they, those belong to Alaska? So you really see here that the Alaskans, the Bristol Bay fishermen, are coming up with some really interesting
ways. Some people
have
a lot of time to think about
that. Yeah, they're coming up with some very interesting ways, none of which, of course, have any legal basis in fact, but interesting ways to try to establish a proprietary interest over the fish. They sound great, yeah.
All right, and let's talk a little bit about a couple other books that you have written that have specific relevance to Alaskans. How about the book that's coming out soon, Fugo, about the balloon invasion? Let's talk just a little bit briefly about that, because I found that fascinating when I saw it online.
Yeah, so my next book will be out this fall, and it's called Fugo, F-U-G-O, which is the code name for the Japanese balloon bombs that were launched in World War II. Some of your listeners may be familiar with this. In the latter days of World War II, the Japanese launched about 9,000 large hydrogen balloons from Japan with the knowledge that when these balloons ascended up around 25 or 30,000 feet, they would enter the strong westerly winds that today we know as the jet stream.
Yeah, they're getting the polar jet. Yeah.
Right. And then those balloons would be carried across the Pacific Ocean and they would reach North America in about 3 to 4 days. So the Japanese launched these balloons. They armed each one with 3 or 4 or 5 bombs, which would be released in a timed sequence after that 4 or 5 day journey. And then once the balloon was somewhere over North America, those bombs would be released. They were incendiary devices packed with thermite, which burns at a very high temperature. And the intent on the part of the Japanese is that the bombs would land in the western states and they would start forest fires, which the Americans would then have to fight by diverting resources that would otherwise be used in the Pacific theater. And so over the course of about 6 months, this is 1944, 1945, they launched 9,000 of these balloons. It's confirmed that about 300 have landed in North America, including about 50 here in Alaska. It's possible as many as 700, 800, 900 landed. It's possible, we might even say probable, that there are still balloons out there yet to be discovered. Of course, most of these landed in remote locations and may not have been discovered. Very little damage was caused by these, a few fires here and there, no material damage to any kind of infrastructure, anything like that. There was one case of fatalities. In southern Oregon, in May 1945, there was a church picnic, and a group of kids found one of these balloons that had landed on the ground. The children picked up the device. One of the bombs detonated. It killed 5 children and their adult chaperone, and that those are the only fatalities on the mainland United States as a result of enemy action in World War II.
All right, and let's talk just for a moment about your other book that's come out about the SS Manhattan.
And so my last book was called Breaking...
This one's actually available.
This one is actually available. In fact, I was in Hearthside yesterday, and there are 2 copies on the shelf, so you can run over there and pick one up.
It might not be 2 after today.
Right, right. Breaking Ice for Arctic Oil is the name of that book, and that's about the SS Manhattan, which was an ice-breaking tanker, sailed the Northwest Passage in 1969. That was an experiment by the oil industry following the discovery at Prudhoe Bay to see if you could transport crude oil using ice-breaking tankers via these circumpolar marine routes, basically load the oil directly from Prudhoe Bay into tankers there in the Arctic Ocean, which would then crash through the polar ice pack and deliver oil to Tokyo, New York, or London. And so Exxon, in 1969, outfitted the SS Manhattan, which was the largest tanker in the U.S. fleet at that time. It was about 155,000 deadweight tons, 1,000 feet in length, converted her to an icebreaker. They sailed her through the Northwest Passage as a real-life, full-scale experiment just to see if a ship could physically make it through the Arctic ice pack. The Manhattan successfully transited the Northwest Passage, proving that it could be done. Exxon determined, however, that it was logistically difficult. The economics were marginal, particularly when compared to a Trans-Alaska pipeline. The project was scrapped. The pipeline was built and, as everyone knows, has been in continuous operation since 1977. So that book is about the Manhattan's voyage and efforts by the oil industry to study these circumpolar marine routes in the late 1960s.
All right, and anybody that wants to read it for details will ultimately tell you what came about as far as how things were determined cost-wise and whether that was deemed infeasible, which ultimately it was. But you get a lot more information if you read Ross's book. And again, that one's available now. Okay, a little bit more about your talk that's going to be given tomorrow. Do you have anything more to add about the Bristol Bay invasion? And of course, again, this is stuff that happened before World War II broke out. The Japanese got involved in it, and before the next previous topic that I did on the empty chair, you know, how that affected Japanese citizens in the United States. So, how did the Japanese feel about this? Obviously, they felt they were well within their rights, as they still do, because they still fish extensively in the Arctic Ocean and just outside of Bristol Bay.
Well, you make a really good point in that these events, this Japanese invasion of Bristol Bay, and I might put invasion in air quotes there. That was how Alaskans referred to it.
It's kind of more like, you know, you're trespassing kind of thing. It wasn't really an invasion. It's more like trespass on
ours. You make an important point that this is happening immediately prior to the Second World War.
Yeah.
It's a time of aggressive Japanese imperialism throughout the Pacific. They've the start of the Sino-Japanese War. They're expanding throughout the Philippines and Indonesia. Their fishermen are going throughout the Pacific realm. And so these Bristol Bay fishermen call it an invasion, and they really do see the entrance of these Japanese fishermen in militaristic terms. They call it an invasion. They see it as a threat. They talk about the pending destruction of Japanese fisheries. There are members of Congress who say, let's just send some U.S. warships up there and sink these Japanese vessels. The Bristol Bay fishermen, they start arming themselves with rifles and they announce their intent to fire on these Japanese vessels. Now, these hostilities did not come to pass, as it turned out. But this is all happening in the context of this sort of militarization of the Pacific, and it goes along with some very crude racial stereotypes that you might imagine on both sides between the Americans and the Japanese that would, of course, become inflamed in just a few years in the Second World War.
Right, and I believe that General Billy Mitchell spoke before Congress in 1935, and he believed that in the future, whoever holds Alaska will hold the world. Now, I think that he probably, and plus these people that came down and actually went to Congress with this issue, probably got a lot of people's ears at that time. And, of course, you know, Alaska is such a jewel out there. That and it's, again, amazing that the only incursion in U.S. territory in World War II was by the Japanese in the Aleutian Islands.
Yeah, absolutely. All of these events were seen in
yeah, it's all kind of it's
in
all
kind
of leading up.
Right?
There is a big, huge string of things that ultimately, you know, that may have been what led to Roosevelt's executive order in February of 1942.
It's certainly connected.
Yeah, it's all these little things that kind of added up into one big thing.
That's right.
Yeah, it was what a mess. But again, flow of information not nearly as good then as it is now. I'm sure that when these people came with their stories, they were taking a lot of it at their word. I mean, there wasn't a whole lot of, you know, there's no YouTube videos to verify everything that had happened. So again, what they said to their congressman was basically taken as gospel. Jesus, these guys came all the way from Alaska to tell us about this. It must be true, and this must really be an issue.
Well, and interestingly enough, there were a handful of Alaskans who actually took to the air in a float plane out of Nushagak, I believe, and they circled this Japanese fleet of fishing boats in Bristol Bay, and they took photographs, and one of the first things that they did, they made it a priority to deliver those photographs to Washington, D.C., And so the visual evidence, the visual record. Not just of the vessels themselves, but they pointed out the gill nets that were spread out on the decks. They pointed out the fish boxes packed with salmon. So they're doing their best to provide just the evidence to show the terms of the invasion that was taking place.
Okay, Ross, remind everybody, it's tomorrow, but remind everybody where you're going to give your talk and at what time.
So the lecture will be tomorrow, Thursday at noon, and it's happening at the State Library, which is in the State Office Building here in downtown Juneau.
Okay, Ross Cohen, thank you very much for being my guest today. Fascinating topics today. It's been just a really good show all the way around.
My pleasure. Thanks
again.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 9th of July, 2014. It was on this day, 1776, the Declaration of Independence was read out loud to George Washington's troops in New York City. They gathered at the parade grounds at 6 o'clock that evening, nearly 30,000 soldiers and sailors. Washington was hoping to raise their morale, and after the declaration was read, soldiers and civilians alike were celebrating in the streets, which turned into a riot. A whole group of them stormed down Broadway down to Bowling Green, where they toppled a 4,000-pound statue of King George III on a horse and smashed it to pieces. The statue was shipped up to Connecticut, where it was melted down and made into lead bullets. It's the birthday of Dean Koontz, born in Everett, Pennsylvania, 1945, the author of horror and suspense novels, who grew up in an impoverished and rather violent home, went away to college, converted to Catholicism, he said, because it helped him make sense of the chaos of his childhood, and to appreciate mysteries in life. He was a prolific author who used 10 different pseudonyms because he was publishing several different books each year. His first bestseller was in 1986, his novel Strangers. It's the birthday of the man who established the first Department of Anthropology in the United States, 1896, at Columbia University, the anthropologist Franz Boas, born in Westphalia, Germany, 1858. Boas, who stressed the need to study four fields, ethnology, linguistics, physical anthropology, and archaeology, before making any generalization about any one culture. And it's the birthday of the novelist Larry Brown, born Oxford, Mississippi, 1951, enlisted in the Marines, came back to Oxford, joined the fire department, loved the job, though it did not pay well. He'd been reading Stephen King's novels, thought maybe he could do that too. His first book of stories, Facing the Music, came out in 1988, and the year after his first novel, Dirty Work. Here's a poem for today by Katrina Vanderberg, Marrying Late. When I think of what it means not to marry the high school sweetheart, but to find each other as we did at ages 30 and 40, I think of John and I singing along to an old cassette of Jackson Brown on car trips, and how, as we sing, a part of me is hearing the song for the first time in Detroit on WRIF with my first boyfriend in his truck as he took curves, shifting hard and fast. And probably John is making love with a black-haired girl in the carpeted back of his van in 1979 out west, the cassette new and popular, draining the battery. How unlikely that we ended up traveling together, singing a song we each learned with someone else. Neither of us minds that the way we might have then. A poem by Katrina Vanderberg, Marrying Late, from her collection Atlas, published by Milkweed Editions and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. And by Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com. Engineered by Noah Smith, produced by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
The second annual Cufflinks and Pearls fundraising gala is back. Join Ha'ani July 26th at 6 p.m. in the Jordan Creek Center for A Night in Monte Carlo. Hosted by Marty Duncan, celebrity chef from the Next Food Network star. Catering by Salt and Suwana Thai Cafe. And fun with casino games, live music, performing arts acts, and more. Tickets available at 586-9251. Brought to you by the Ha'ani Community Development Fund.
It's 3:45 p.m. You're listening to KTOO 104.3 in Juneau. Juneau Police and the Alaska Electric Light and Power Company want people to know about a telephone scam that hit the capital city today. Several businesses and residential customers report getting phone calls from a person saying their power will be cut off in 45 minutes if they don't make an immediate payment. The caller has been telling people to go to Walmart or Fred Meyer and buy a prepaid Green Dot or credit card to make the payment. Of course, this is fraudulent. Utility companies do not operate by demanding cash or threatening people over the phone. AEL&P spokeswoman Debbie Driscoll says the scam is similar to several that have hit Juneau over the last few months. And while we're waiting for our next guest, Carolyn Servid, to show up, I'm going to play a little bit of Fleetwood Mac. It's called As Long As You Follow.
Like the kind is Bird Note. Seabirds gather where food is abundant, at the edge of North America's continental shelf, where nutrient-rich waters nurture a wealth of squid and small fish. Let's go take a look. It's a summer day off the coast of North Carolina. We set sail east over 75 feet of water, but it's not long before the seafloor drops off more than 12,000 feet, and things change. Seabird researcher Tom Johnson explains.
Right at the greatest amount of slope of that seafloor, there's an area of upwelling and productivity. And in that area, in a very small area, you can have very large flocks of shearwaters and storm petrels, boreal migrants like jaegers, meeting perhaps South Polar skuas coming up from the Antarctic, seabirds that are coming from all corners of the Atlantic Ocean.
What's it like to experience this remarkable convergence?
To have the opportunity to wake up in the morning and be offshore in blue water that's thousands of feet deep, out of sight of land, and encountering birds that are flying alongside of each other but who hatched at different ends of the earth is an opportunity that I just am overwhelmed by, and I feel incredibly fortunate to be out there sharing the ocean with these animals.
Learn about Tom Johnson's research on seabirds at birdnote.org.
Hey, it's 3:51 p.m. You're listening to K2OO. Wow, that's tough down sometimes. 104.3 in Juneau. And public service announcement, the start time for the meeting of the full assembly sitting as Human Resources Committee to interview applicants for the Docks and Harbors and Airport Boards on Thursday, July 10th, 2014. That's tomorrow. Has been changed to 5:45 instead of 5:30 and will be held in the City Hall Conference Room number 224. Immediately following the adjournment of the HRC, there'll be a special assembly meeting for the purposes of making appointments to the Docks and Harbors and Airport Boards. The above meeting agendas can be found online at www.juno.org/assembly/novus.php. And for additional information, you can contact Deputy Clerk Beth McEwen at 586-0203 or via email at beth_mcewen@ci.juno.ak.us. And we're hoping to get Carolyn Servide from the Sitka Alaska Institute on the show with us, but perhaps that'll be rescheduled for another day. Right now, here's Peter Griffin's story, a short one. This is called Talks with Wolves.
A friend and I were pulling Dungeness crab pots in a remote bay near Ketchikan, Alaska, on one of those fall days when a cold, rainy drizzle turns into ice pellets. We stacked the pots in the skiff and debated whether or not to make the 20-mile run back home in the sleet with our bucket of crabs or to go ashore and build a fire. As we sat in the skiff discussing the situation, we heard a low moan come from the woods, a moan that rose in volume, continuing for about 10 seconds. Norm and I looked at each other and grinned. We had just heard a wolf howl. They say wolves howl as a means of communicating with other wolves. Nobody has ever interviewed the wolves to ask them why. It seems like howling is a way for packs to call each other to the site of a kill, or a way for wolves to bond together, or a way for one wolf pack to let the others know about territorial boundaries. But I learned that this tendency to howl is useful in another way. As a wildlife biologist, I transferred from the Huron-Manistee National Forest in Michigan to the Chippewa National Forest in northern Minnesota in 1987. There I had responsibilities for wildlife recreation and fire. Unlike Michigan, there were wolves on the Chippewa. There was a pack to the north that expanded its range onto my district each winter in search of food. We would see occasional wolf tracks out in the woods and every once in a while hear about a wolf sighting. Employees would report to me that they'd seen one of my wolves. When our district reorganized how work was going to be accomplished, I suggested that we hire a new full-time wildlife biologist to work with the folks in timber management. I'd found out there was far more work than I could reasonably do well. Because timber cutting had the greatest effect on wildlife habitat, I figured we needed a full-time biologist working directly with the forester on the district. I was willing to give up that role for which I'd been schooled and trained in order for the district to improve its wildlife management program. So we hired Paul, a young man with a Ph.D. in wildlife who had extensive experience outside the agency. After a couple of years, we started getting regular reports of wolf sightings during the summer and more frequent stories about pets disappearing from backyards. We needed to find a way to take stock of the wolf population, so our new biologist, Paul, devised a howling survey to locate wolf packs. It wasn't a one-man job. It was going to take a lot of help. Now, the way he went about this was to take our folks to the International Wolf Center in Ely, Minnesota, to be trained in the art of howling. All of our employees, foresters, recreation managers, timber sale administrators, business managers, and even the district ranger learned how to howl and how to interpret wolf howls they might receive in return.
Okay, we're going to see if we can't get Carolyn on the phone with us. Hi, Carolyn, are you with me?
I am.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing just great, thanks.
All right, let's talk a little about Sitka's Island Institute real quick.
Well, we're hosting the 2014 Sitka Symposium in about 10 days, which is the event we wanted to highlight for your Juno listeners and invite people to join us over here. It starts on July 20th in the evening, and it runs that next week through the 26th. The symposium is a gathering looking at writing and ideas, and it's centered on a theme every year, and we invite guest faculty of, that's a formal term, it's their guest speakers, but to help us think about this theme. So our theme this year is Radical Imagining, Changing the Story with Stories of Change. And what we're interested in is empowering people to think about ways they can instigate change in their own communities, in their own lives, in their workplaces, whatever, that help them feel less daunted by the circumstances of the world these days, with challenges with climate change and challenges with the economy and with, I think a lot of people would say, with our political system right now, which is deadlocked so often. All of these things that make ordinary folks feel like they are disempowered, and we're looking for stories that exemplify people instigating change on their own and making a difference in their own communities. So that's what we're going to be thinking about, and we have an amazing lineup of guest speakers to help us think about that. They're all activists in their own way with these kinds of issues. The person that may be the best known is Native American activist Winona LaDuc, who is coming from Minnesota. She's being joined by science journalist Alan Wiseman, whose best-selling books include The World Without Us and his newest book, Countdown. Both of those look at the human place on the planet, one without us and one with us. Luis Alberto Urrea, who is a Latino writer known for his work in the borderlands area. He's originally from Tijuana and moved to San Diego as a young boy, but has spent a lot of time with immigrant people trying to get into the U.S. and also with people living in poverty and lending a great deal of dignity to the lives of people who are much less fortunate than many of us. Then the last person is a composer and performer, Molly Sturgis, who's a community arts activist in Santa Fe and does remarkable work making the arts a voice for individuals in the community. And she'll be joining us with these other three folks. So we're looking forward to a great week, talks by all these people, discussions. There are a series of evening events that are open to the public as well, some readings, a film night, local storytelling night, and dinner cruise. So okay. It's a packed week, and we're still accepting people with full registration, or if folks from Juneau can come over for maybe part of the week and get in on individual events, they're welcome to do that as well.
Okay, Carolyn, thank you very much for joining us at the very end of our show today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, and this is KTOO in Juneau. We broadcast 104.3 FM in Juneau and a bunch of different translators. We're also on GCI cable. You can pick us up there. And now let's join All Things Considered. Thanks for joining me today on the afternoon. Have a great day.
9th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The president today urged women to turn out in a pivotal Senate race.
Also, U.S.-German relations are tense over allegations of American spying.
They executed a search warrant in Berlin today, in office and residence.